people, thanks for listening to THC and taking a serious look at some of the most underappreciated topics and ideas on the planet today. UFOs, HARP, a resource-based economy, archons, psychedelics, MKUltra, mind control, Hollywood sorcery, self-sustainability, and a ton of other stuff. We want the truth about the topics that spark our curiosity and expose corruption, but it's become buried in an avalanche of glee in the Fast and the Furious movies. Well, not anymore. Folks, if you like listening to the show week after week, please take a second to nominate us in the 2013 Stitcher Awards, the most prestigious podcast awards known to man. And what could be a real shining star on the Higher Side Chat's resume? It gives your humble host the clout necessary to remove all barriers that may stand in the way of reaching potential guests and allows the momentum to continue. So please take a second to find a link on my Facebook, Twitter, or the Google itself for the 2013 Stitcher Awards and write THC and wherever you think it fits. Why not try to sweep the whole damn thing? But particularly, let me extract your precious nomination in the science and medicine category. I don't know why our show is listed there, but we're 14th in that category, which means we're in the ballpark, but we're going to need the whole team to make it happen. We're 14th. That's pretty good. 14th above Michio Kaku, above Scientific American, above National Geographic. Don't get me wrong. We've done great things this year, you and I. But a nomination in the Stitcher Awards means putting Lennon Honor and Freeman Fly and Wendy Tremaine and Jim Elvidge and Jock Fresco alongside people like Rachel Maddow, Joe Rogan, NPR, and ESPN, because those are the people who will win the 2013 Stitcher Awards, and that's okay. But help me put Project Monarch alongside fantasy football. Help me put Crop Circles alongside the NBC Nightly News, even for just one day, and I'd say we've come further than we ever have. So please, vote every day between now and December 22nd. This year, let's get on that ballot. And next year, that's the year we go for the gold. Your move, Higher Side Chatters.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
Merry fucking Christmas, Higher Side Chatters. Drinking the drink, smoking the smoke, trying to enjoy just a few minutes of peace this holiday season. You know your humble host still has a regular retail job managing a video game store, which has been hell these past few weeks, as I'm sure you can imagine. I just want to curl up into a ball and cry for so many reasons. And all I want for Christmas is to get on the ballot of the 2013 Stitcher Awards. Nominations are going on now until Christmas Eve. They extended it a couple of days. And good on them. I'm also hoping for solid participation in the THC Money Bomb. You know, if we get just 10% of the audience donating $5 every month and getting in the pool, I'll be able to quit my job, a real dream come true, and I'll be giving away $1,000 a month to one of you guys. I'm sure 10% of the audience buys scratch-off tickets. Look, I love gambling, and when I buy $5 scratch-offs and just win another scratch-off, I'm like, holy shit, I won something, which is so stupid. You could just donate to THC and have like a 1 in 50 chance of getting back a large chunk of money, better than any Powerball or scratch-off that I know about, and it helps people. But yeah, I'm so grateful for all the emails and messages and reviews. I love how far we've come. I'm very lucky. Anyway, this is a great show with Neil Sanders, who really knows his shit when it comes to analyzing mind control mechanisms in Hollywood and the entertainment industry, rattling off connections between pedophile rings and celebrities and well-known institutions. I really like this one. Pretty rapid fire. So with that, I'm going to read a little news and we're going to get this ball rolling and get this party started.
Hi, everybody. Over the past month, I've been visiting towns across America, talking about what our country needs to secure a better bargain for the middle class. Some form of higher education.
All right, guys, if you've been flying in or out of Denver this week, double check. Make sure you got all your kids. Veterans Today is issuing a kidnapping warning saying that on today, December 22nd, each year at midnight, or what is known as the winter solstice, the Illuminati Council of 13 bankers hold their Tiffany lamp meetings. These known Satanists perform human sacrifices as part of their satanic rituals at the Old Navarre, a former whorehouse and casino located in Denver, Colorado. Apparently, during these rituals, a recently kidnapped human infant is killed and sacrificed to Satan. The Satanists then drink the blood of the infant they sacrifice. This group is known as the Illuminati Bankers, or the U.S. Shadow Government, and the leaders of this group have included George H.W. Bush, Leonard Milman, Larry Mitzel, Henry Kissinger, David Rockefeller, Ansar Ben-Shari, the head rabbi of Israel, and others unnamed. And for all the fluoride believers, here's some great news for the sweets-filled holiday season. A doctoral candidate at Tulane University discovered an unlikely player in the fight against tooth decay, an extract derived from the cocoa bean. Using leftover human molars, he applied either fluoride or cocoa extract. Next, the teeth were placed in a specialized machine which pressed an indentation into each tooth. The depth of the depression indicates the hardness of the enamel. He observed that the teeth treated with cocoa extract were more resilient than those where fluoride was used. In a second test, each tooth was left overnight in a solution of either fluoride or cocoa extract. The following day, they subjected the tooth surface to strong acid for 10 minutes. When they measured the amount of calcium that had leached into the acid, they found that the teeth soaked in cocoa extract had lost 8% less calcium than their fluoride counterparts. And here's a good little end-of-the-year TSA story. As many of you know, when asked to empty our pockets at airport security, travelers are quick to oblige, placing wallets, cell phones, and spare change in the basket. And in a rush to collect belongings and quickly head to the gates for departure, stray coins can be an afterthought for some passengers. Well, last year, those afterthoughts totaled over $500,000. And where does this hunk of change go? Well, according to the TSA Loose Change Act, the TSA has authority to retain and spend, without annual appropriation, unclaimed money left at security checkpoints by air passengers for activities related to aviation security. Well, the TSA collected over $500,000 in 2012 as well, and the agency had only spent $6,500 by the end of the fiscal year. Isn't that interesting? The top five airports stealing our shit: Miami International, $39,000. McCarran International in Las Vegas, $26,900. O'Hare International in Chicago, $22,000. LAX, $21,900. And JFK International, just under $21,000. Well, ain't that some shit? There's your higher education for the week. Here is Neil Sanders. Here we go, people. We've heard about the darkest of dark government black projects like MKUltra and Project Monarch, and we've talked about some of the textbook cases of celebrity mind control victims unraveling live on the 8 o'clock news. But how deep does this manipulation go? How vast and wide are these networks? Who's involved? And just how well-oiled is this machine? Well, people, it seems like Britney Spears and Miley Cyrus are just the tip of the iceberg, and today's guest has quickly become one of my favorite speakers on the subject. His name is Neil Sanders, and he has a Master of Arts in Film Studies, studied psychology and media production for his BA honors, and is a qualified hypnotherapist. Neil is considered an expert on the subject of mind control and has been studying the history of this dark art and its application by military and government agencies across the globe and inside Hollywood for many years. And he's the author of Your Thoughts Are Not Your Own, Volumes 1 and 2. Neil, welcome to THC.
Hi, thank you very much for having me on, Greg.
Yeah, man, it's a pleasure to have you here. Your background and education are pretty interesting in the context of these subjects that we're going to talk about. And we know movies can be a huge tool of propaganda and opinion shaping. Did your study of film have any influence on your journey down this rabbit hole?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of it, sort of when you sort of start to investigate the financing. I mean, there's two elements of the film industry that sort of started piquing my interest. Mm-hmm. One was the use of psychology, particularly Freudian psychology and Jungian archetypes and that sort of thing, in the framing of just something as simple as the framing of a villain, say. You know, they'll be very, very smoothly dressed. They might have a scar or something like that. You know, there's certain things that will dictate who's the bad guy and who's the good guy. One of the simplest is to have a dog or a cat. Like, you know, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. They give halfway through, they give Clint Eastwood a kitten to play with. So we know he's all right, really. You know, and he's offed about 100 people already by that time. But, you know, he's nice with the cat, so we're all right with him. And then, so there's all that sort of element. And other things that you wouldn't initially, I mean, some things are obvious like that, the framing of who the enemy is. You know, there was a conscious shift whilst I was actually studying, really, from Russians to Islamic fundamentalists. You know, we had a lot of films like Rambo and stuff like that, where the second Rambo and various Rocky and all this, where the concept is that the Russians are essentially the enemy. And then you get in crossover films like Red Heat with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it's trying to soften off. And then all of a sudden, the paradigm shifts, and then the people who are actually the good guys in Rambo 2 are all of a sudden the bad guys in True Lies, and you know, and various films like that. So I started to notice that, hang on, there really are themes that run through the sort of construction of reality in films, basically. And then the other thing is when you start to notice the financing and the marketing aspects of films, and you realise that they're not pieces of art. I mean, you might get a piece of art out of that, but more often than not, that's not really the point of it. It's something to be sold. It's a commodity. You know, the director may have an artistic view, the actors may have an artistic view, but the studios are in the business of making money because they're a business.
Right.
And then when you get to see the sort of the how certain films don't get made, or very nearly don't get made, like Apocalypse Now very nearly didn't get made purely because it was seen to be derogatory of the American military and their sort of time in Vietnam, and so they were refused any access to any aspect of the military, whereas films like James Bond, for example, they will get the military helping them and providing props and uniforms, you know, anything that there might be, locations, weaponry, anything like that, on the understanding that they have a final rewrite of the script. And I believe it was Tomorrow Never Dies, there's a boat gets stolen. And in the original script, it was going to be an American boat. And so this is, well, we can't do that. And so they made it into a French boat that was stolen. And actually, they were filming some scenes in Paris. So the French government said, well, you can't do that. And in the end, they basically made it a Canadian because they didn't actually need any Canadians in that particular film. And the one that really got me was The Winter Palace, the concept of the storming of the Winter Palace during the Russian Revolution. Basically, this is a widely talked about incident that is actually appears in several history books as if it was a real incident. And it wasn't. It was a complete propaganda exercise. I believe the film was, it's October, 10 days, I forget the full title, but it's a Sergei Eisenstein film. And essentially, the real storming of the Winter Palace was a load of basically inept Russian rebels that ran into the palace, got lost, and had to be escorted out by the only few remaining servants that were there. But then this was filmed and mocked up. There was two acts. One was a live stage show, a stage production, where they actually mocked up an attack on the palace. And then this was filmed and made into a film by Sergei Eisenstein. And this was put out, and it showed the huge Russian Tsar's army being beaten back by the proud peasants' army and the people's army, and going in there and standing on tables and waving bits of paper about. And it was a huge moral victory. It was a great big symbolic entity. But the problem is that this never happened. But but what's strange is that this has now become absorbed into the lexicon of history to the point where people believe it to happen. Same thing with things like Marie Antoinette never actually said, "Let them eat cake." That was a quote that was attributed to her, that has been attributed to at least two people before them. It's just an expression of this woman as a tyrant. But 9 out of 10 people would tell you that was a factual, happening, basically. So, and that's obviously not film, but film does run that gamut. I mean, let's just look at Argo. Argo's pure CIA propaganda. I mean, it's nonsense. The story's not historically accurate. And it's just basically a way of saying, look how great we are. I mean, there's been a few recently. Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty are the most obvious. Both of them, I will tell you now, got extensive funding from the US military and intelligence agencies. Right. And I'll tell you for why. Because they use military equipment. And there's no way that they could have that military equipment if they didn't have the say-so in the final right of the CIA's Hollywood Liaison Bureau, which used to be run by George Tenet, but isn't any. I'm not sure who runs it now. I forget the guy's name. But basically, as I say, these are propaganda pieces. I mean, Zero Dark Thirty is incredibly – they're recruitment tools aside from anything, because they justify being a psychopath in the Hurt Locker and just the sort of that they basically hype up war. This is the tagline: war is a drug.
Yeah.
And you know, and and then Zero Dark Thirty, for example, that's very clever because publicly they disavow any connection to it and say the torture scenes, that's Hollywood fiction. But if you know the mechanics of how Hollywood gets its financing, they must have been in on it. They must have had the say-so on the final draft of the script.
Yeah.
So what they get to do there is basically say, oh, no, we'd never do that, whilst sort of winking and basically pressing up against you and going, we do this, and we'll do it to you if you don't toe the line. It's a brilliant way of having the cake and eat it too, basically. I mean, the famous recruitment tool was Top Gun, which famously actually had recruitment booths outside the cinema.
No way, never heard that.
Yeah, when the film finished, basically there were Navy and Army recruitment booths put up directly outside. You know, essentially, do you want to be Tom Cruise? Do you want to be Val Kilmer? Yeah, and that is very, very powerful. I mean, this is the whole point of the media. I mean, Edward Bernays was the first person to publicly acknowledge the sort of propaganda power of the media, because it sets people's precedents. I've never seen a panda, for example, and this is a glib example, but I know what a panda is like because I've seen it on the television.
Yeah.
And so if you were less informed, or if you had a narrower viewing field, perhaps you would assume that all Muslims were exactly like they're portrayed on Fox News.
Right.
And what that is I forget what it's called now. I've gone simple. It's Gross and Gerbner. Cultivation theory. I do apologize. Yeah, and it's essentially the concept that the more you watch television, the more you come to believe that this is a realistic representation of reality. Mm-hmm. And it's so it bleeds backwards and forwards. Mean world syndrome is the concept that I'm sure you're familiar with. It's basically people think that the world is a far scarier place and believe that racial stereotypes or ethnic stereotypes are more threatening, because that's the only example that they get on the programs that they watch.
Right.
And so, yeah, it really does affect people. I mean, this is where people get the concept of xenophobia, or, you know, is from being misinformed. And, you know, this is the point. Films, particularly when they're sort of financed by CIA or CA slush funds and such like that, they are an incredibly powerful medium.
Right. There's a reason they're investing in it at that level.
Yeah. I mean, aside from the sort of, just to bring it more, back to more tangible things, they'll set trends. They'll tell you how you want to have your hair done, or who you... I had a friend that looked a little bit like... he's still my friend, who looked a little bit like Leonardo DiCaprio. And when... Titanic came out, he was fighting girls off with a shitty stick, right? Purely because he looked like the alpha male at the time. He's the most desirable person that's on the pedestal at the minute. But it can set, you know, at the minute, everyone's got 1940s hairdos in England with a sort of swept back, Michael Fassbender and The Great Gatsby and various Inception. They started doing their hair like that in that. And Prometheus and various other films, and very subtly this sort of bleeds in, and people assume that it's organic, because this is one of the fundamental tenets of selling something, is to convince somebody that they've not been sold to.
Right.
You know, this is how fashions, all of a sudden everybody is wearing skinny fit jeans. Is that because everybody suddenly got up one morning and went, my testicles aren't constricted enough, I need to get them like tight in this denim? Like, no, it's because all of a sudden Lil Wayne started wearing them, and so started wearing them, and every metal band in the world started wearing them, and, you know, all of these different things. And so this is where precedents get set.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other aspect of film that's quite strange is that the direct correlation with the intelligence agencies, for example, it's long been suggested that people like Errol Flynn was perhaps a Nazi spy. Utilizing his, entertainment credentials to move in and out or to pass information. Cary Grant reportedly worked for MI6. Whether this is true, we don't know. Greta Garbo was going to assassinate Hitler. apparently. And one thing that's certainly true is I'm terribly sorry, but my memory's gone, his name's gone. The producer of the film Fight Club has recently been exposed to be an asset of the Mossad.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. It was very, very recently, actually, that it came out. So wow. If people want to Google that, they'll find out that that's the way. But entertainment, I mean, it's two things. One, it's brilliant because people assume that it's just entertainment, so they don't really expect nefarious activities.
The guard's
activities.
Down.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, and the other thing is they'll put up with a certain amount of debauchery and what could be called bad behavior because, hey, you know, we're living vicariously through these rock stars. Mm-hmm. But then the other thing is the way that certain people can be utilized. I mean, depending on what you believe, obviously, Bob Hope was apparently an American spy.
And a handler.
Yes, you know, Bryce Taylor, sorry. And, basically, that may well be true. There's certainly a lot of sort of corresponding evidence from Walter Bauer, who was another researcher. He sort of remembers running into Bryce Taylor with Bob Hope at some sort of inaugural function that he just so happened to be with, and then met her again years later when he discovered that she was a mind control agent.
Just real quick, for those people who don't know exactly what we're talking about, Bob Hope is allegedly a handler for the child pornography ring, the child prostitution ring that goes throughout Hollywood and the political elite.
Yeah, and I mean, it's what's certainly true is he didn't write any of his jokes. He was a performer, not a comedian. So if you have that skill, I mean, that certainly frees up a lot of time, doesn't it? And obviously, he was famous for being at sort of USO shows and stuff like that, and going into places where there was conflict happening. Other people that were certainly intelligence agents were John Mulholland, who was a very, very famous in his time in the sort of late 50s. Late 40s, was a very famous magician, and he was particularly good at sleight of hand tricks. And what he did was he was the person that actually taught the CIA how to put LSD into people's drinks without them noticing.
Hmm.
And he actually wrote a manual, which is still available, you know, it's still utilized by the intelligence agencies. Houdini was the same. Apparently, when he was supposed to be in the box for hours and hours on end, he'd gone out a trapdoor and was off killing people for Uncle Sam. Quite similar to Chuck Barris.
Yeah, Chuck Barris.
You know, the guy that did the Gong Show and Blind Date, it's called in England. I think it's called, I don't know what it's called in America, the Date Show or whatever it was called.
Yeah, Dating Game.
Yeah, that's the one.
What's funny about that one is there's the book and the movie about it. And that's kind of another strange aspect of film that I've always thought was interesting in the conspiracy world is that the idea that people put out real secrets in these films so that when researchers come out with information exposing these things, the public won't accept it because they associate it with the movie like Stargate, you know.
Yeah, someone comes out and says, deniability, isn't it?
Right.
Because it's the first thing that they go to, you know. I saw a little brown alien being chased by the government. No, you didn't. You watched E.T. because it's their sort of go-to reference for it, really, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, the other sort of aspect that's very strange, particularly with the film and the music industry, is obviously the intertwining of drugs and organized crime. And this, again, runs the gamut. I mean, The mafia essentially started the music industry with the sort of jukebox wars and then moving on to payola to make sure that their particular artists, it's like the industry run protection racket, essentially. They were making sure certain people got into certain parts. It's interesting what you said. You know the bit in The Godfather where Johnny Fontaine? He comes to me, says, I want a part, but this guy won't give me a part because I got this girl pregnant, and it winds up with him putting a horse's head in. That's a true story. It was Frank Sinatra that wanted the part, and I believe it was Sam Giancana, but I could be hideously wrong about that, so forgive me if I am. But essentially, the mafia don that he was associated with put a gun to this man's head and said, he's in the film, he's in From Here to Eternity. And lo and behold, he wasn't From Here to Eternity. I mean, don't muck about. Frank Sinatra grew up next door to Lucky Luciano in Sicily. And he was a bagman for the mafia. He wasn't, I mean, this is the other thing, like Frank Sinatra would be considered like, you know, one of the top celebrities, untouchable. And he was completely indebted and terrified of the mafia. So, you know, this is the thing, it's all an image, isn't it? I mean, this is one of the other things about the music industry and the film industry. They present unsustainable and unrealistic expectations and lifestyles. The majority of musicians don't make a lot or, in fact, any money. A lot of them come out of it not doing particularly well. If you look at bands, just think about three bands that were huge 2 years ago. And where are they now? You've not heard of them. I've got friends that have been signed to major record labels and indie record labels and various different types of things. And to a man, every one of them came out owing money. Like, I mean, we just recently had, like, I don't know, a crap group, obviously, but this band N-Dubs, they're all going to be bankrupt very, very soon because it's all for show. You've got to get this lifestyle going on. But then, obviously, the public buy into that, and so they want to get this aspirational quality and be like these alpha people. And the way to do that, obviously, is to buy a big car and shiny jewellery. All of this lark, and it's nonsense. I mean, there's various people in industry insiders that will tell you this. I mean, Biggie Smalls, best rapper ever, had $15,000 in the bank when he died, not enough to pay his mortgage. So, you know, he was broke, he was bankrupt, he was absolutely broke. Like MC Hammer, it's a silly example, but MC Hammer went from being the most profitable artist on the planet to being bankrupt within a year.
Now, let me ask you a little bit about that, because, you know, when you get into this stuff with people participating in the child prostitution rings and these strange rituals. Do you, when you see someone, I once made the joke that a one hit wonder is just somebody who wasn't going to play ball once they got invited to the parties. Like, do you think there's an element of that? Like, if someone stays on the top for a long time, they must be good at keeping the secret? Or do you think, you know, they get erased if they aren't cool with it all?
I think it very much depends on the person, because, I mean, this is one of the sort of things that people say, well, so hang on, so everybody that's been in it has been through some sort of satanic ritual, and you don't necessarily need that to control people, because purely on a sort of financial feeding of the ego, you know, don't put out a song questioning 9/11 because all your sponsors will disappear. Don't do this because you'll become the Dixie Chicks and we're going to ruin you, and only when you make a massive apology are we going to bring you back, because it very much depends on what the agenda of the artist is, because, you know, some of it is there just to make money and some of it is there to make statements. And so it's a very, very interesting point. Does Lady Gaga understand what she's doing when she's doing sort of ritual sacrifice epithets on stage, or is she just following what her choreographers told her?
Right. That is the question.
Well, this is the question. Then when you get into the sort of realms of multiple personalities and such like that, then it becomes even more complicated and, you know, difficult for people to sort of hang on to. And, you know, it moves off into different strands. It's very difficult to know. Some record companies exist purely to – they make their money by having not successful artists. Like, they'll pump out one single and then that artist is indebted to them. For example, right, if you get a $1 million record label, right, okay, 5-album $1 million record deal, which is what everyone gets on The X Factor and America's Got Talent and all these crap shows, okay, because it sounds great, $1 million or £1 million, 5 albums, wow. Let me explain what that is. That is a £1 million loan, right? Mm-hmm. And with that loan, which you have to pay back, they're going to help you promote the project that is you. And so everything that comes out of that, everything, right, from that day forward, everything, every penny that is spent by that record company in the promoting of you comes out of that £1 million. If you make some money off the single, you'll get 5% of the profit of 10%. Yeah. So if you make enough of that, you'll get some money back, but you will pay back that $1 million. Now, what does the 5-album deal mean? So that means that you're contracted to that company for 5 albums. It doesn't mean that they have to put out 5 albums, but it means that you can't go anywhere else until you've completed those 5 albums, unless you want to buy out of the deal, which can be very, very expensive. So if your first album doesn't do particularly well, then they've got no obligation to ever let you perform again. But you can't play live, you can't go to another record company, you can't produce music independently, because then you're committing you know, you're defrauding the company or whatever it is.
Ben Folds, I'm a big fan of, but he has song. He has a song called One Down, and the lyrics are one down and 3.6 tomorrow, and then I'm out of here. And it's literally about him having to churn out 4.6 songs before his contract's up. Whatever 0.6 of a song is, who knows?
Well, I mean, famously, Lou Reed did that nonsense. Was it, I can't remember, it was Metal Machine, it might be called. I might have got that wrong again. I apologize. It was basically a nonsensical drone noise album, and it was just to basically fulfill a contract. But I don't think you can do that anymore. I think they've got loopholes and stuff that
yeah, they close all that up.
Yeah, absolutely. The concept of multiple personalities as well, people would say that's very, very strange. But a surprising amount of people that go through the milieu end up having them. I've assumed that, you know, people have talked about Britney Spears and stuff like that. Lindsay Lohan apparently has a multiple personalities, one called Diane and one called Margot. You know, it's very, very, very strange. And then you've got other people like Beyonce, who's recently come out as now Yonce rather than Sasha Fierce, and that have got professional alter egos, if you like.
Yeah, it's so weird. I don't know why we accept. Nobody I know in my regular life just changes their name, but yet these celebrities, they do it all the time. And some people chalk it up to ego service, but there are some weird occult, esoteric symbolism and meanings behind some of these name changes. It's really odd.
Well, I mean, what's Nicki Minaj? Is it Zoman Polanski or was Roman Zelansky or something? Obviously, you know, which is slightly strange because obviously Roman Polanski is very dark and obviously... Mm-hmm.
Pedophile?
Yeah, pedophile. He drugged and sodomized a 13-year-old girl. Like, this is another strange thing that you can... The paedophilia aspect, sometimes it's fine if you're a successful artist. What's really strange is that Gary Glitter, Jonathan King, you're not allowed to have his records on the radio anymore, unless it's Pink Floyd or any of the ones that, you know, are making money, obviously. Mm-hmm. And they still get royalties for it, obviously. But Wilfred Bramble, who was Steptoe in Steptoe and Son, he's a known paedophile. They still show Steptoe and Son. Let's think of R. Kelly. R. Kelly married Aaliyah when she was 15, and you know, he pissed on that 14-year-old girl. He's mm-hmm. a known pedophile. Jimmy Page ran off with a 13-year-old girl. Steven Tyler legally adopted a 16-year-old girl and then gave her cocaine while she was having an abortion. Ted Nugent married a 16-year-old girl. Roman Polanski raped a 13-year-old girl. Elvis Presley married a 14-year-old girl. Jerry Lee Lewis married a 13-year-old girl. You can get away with it.
Yeah. Woody Allen, his own daughter.
Yeah, Woody Allen, not just his own daughter, like several of his adopted daughters. And who's the other one? Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones. And I was watching a program called The A to Z of Zeppelin, Led Zeppelin, because I'm a big fan of Zeppelin. But like Pamela DeBars, who wrote I'm With the Band, she's a world famous groupie. She was the first groupie that wrote a tell-all book about the subject. She was basically saying, and then all of a sudden all these little girls came into Hollywood, and these are little girls, you know, babies like 12, 13, 14, and the bands were fascinated with them. And I was sat there thinking, that's not okay, you know. that's right. Not all right. Yes, and the manner in which it was sort of, at no point did anyone say, hang on, sorry, what, 13 years old, did you say? Like, yeah, it's incredible. But
well, now again, on your side of the world, you got the that lead singer from The Lost Prophets. He's pleading guilty to raping a baby and filming it, and him and some of his groupies had sex with their own kids.
Yes, yeah. There's certain injunctions in England that mean you can't find out or talk about certain elements of the case, mostly to protect the children's identity and stuff like that. But actually, it's a bit weird.
Right, so they say. It's a convenient excuse for them as well.
No, I mean, I completely appreciate that. And, you know, if, like, but it's a very, very strange case. I can't believe it. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. I think it's very, very strange that people like Ian Watkins, these things do come out. I'll tell you for why I think strange about Ian Watkins. This is not, if you're into metal, which I am, like 10 years ago when I was at Rock City in Nottingham, we all knew that he was a paedophile then. because they'd played in Nottingham, and we knew girls that he'd been going out with and stuff that were 14. Like, it's been on websites and discussion forums for years and years and years that he likes young girls. He's got a website up called motherless.com, and if you go on there, there's blatant links to child pornography on it, and this has been up for years and years and years. Five different separate police agencies were approached about this, and it took seemingly at least 4 years for this to come to light. Very similar time to the Jimmy Savile case coming to life, obviously after he died and that. And it's, again, my I wonder if this is basically because at a similar time we had a scenario in England where certain care homes in Wales were being exposed as basically being brothels for politicians and high-profile celebrities run by MI5 and MI6. And it seemed to detract the celebrity rush, you know, Jimmy Savile sleeping with dead bodies, Jimmy Savile's doing this, and all these other celebrities like previously beloved like Rolf Harris and such are getting accused of various things as well. I think that's a distraction from
from
the very real cases that are involved with MI6 and MI5, and it is a practice of the intelligence agencies. Two of the proven, like, admitted people that were used in cases of child prostitution, Christine Di Nicola and Claudia Mullen, and they in 1995 received apologies for the radiation experiments from President Clinton, and they spoke about being prostituted and used with hidden cameras for entrapment techniques. And you know, this is when they were sort of 9 years old, basically. This is when she was sent to, Claudia Mullen was sent to a place called Deep Creek Cabins when she was nine to learn how to sexually please men. So,
wow.
You know, yeah, exactly. And this is all on record, and this is admitted. And she named people like Sidney Gottlieb and Morse Allen and Ewan Cameron, who are all not only MK Ultra doctors, MK Ultra being the umbrella term for the CIA's mind control program, but also incredibly well thought of people within the sort of psychological industry anyway. These were like, it's kind of like the equivalent of Dr. Phil doing it or something like that, basically. And like, they were eminent professionals within their field. And it, maybe this is perhaps sort of why they got away with this. But I mean, it's not, and this is where it starts to tie in again with the sort of organized crime. That in England, the famous gangsters were called the Cray Twins, and the Cray Twins, basically, their downfall came when it was exposed that they were running rent boys through the Houses of Lords, particularly with Lord Boothby. Now, later sort of allegations or suggestions have come out that certain DJs were, like the Mafia payola scam, indebted to the firm, which was the Cray's gangster organization. And they were Alan Freeman and Jimmy Savile. Whether this is true or not, certain other people have been suggested, like pop stars and such, were suggested to be friends with them. What's certainly true is that all the carry-on, do you get the carry-on films in America? Like Barbara Windsor and Sid James and all that. They were all friends with the Krays and Ronnie Knight and all these gangsters and stuff like that, because they were the in-crowd of London society.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very basic.
On the, I wanted to hop back to the subject of the cover story, because, you know, most recently Paul Walker just died in a car accident from the Fast and the Furious movies, and a friend of mine brought to my attention this idea of the Google bomb, which is kind of a weird idea, but it's the idea of managing search terms, because Fast and the Furious was a scandal, a U.S. government scandal of them running guns to Mexico and selling them. So now when people search Fast and the Furious, they're going to see more about Paul Walker's death, and it covers up. It is, but the timing's a little weird. I feel like that story was like 6 months ago. No one even cares about it now, but it is weird.
Well, I mean, this is what happens. I've had a lot of emails from people saying that Paul Walker was definitely killed by the Illuminati because X, Y, and Z and stuff like that. And I've not seen anything that has led me to believe that it was anything more than an accident. I mean, certain interesting things. I might be wrong, but there's a danger with certain things that people have an idea and then they fit the evidence around the idea. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Rather than, of course.
And fair enough, people at least are doing something, but sometimes you need to just take stock and critique your own work, basically, like, and go, you know what, I was wrong about that, but hey-ho, to err is human. So, you know, these things happen, basically. I mean, just to tie back to the point that I was making about, you know, when you send the cover stories and there's the, I mean, it's admitted that there's a, not only the care homes were being utilized by people such as Cyril Smith, the disgraced MP, who's also, along with Jimmy Savile, been connected to quasi satanic rituals and such like that in the, you know, whilst this was happening. But various people have actually admitted publicly. Edwina Currie admitted in her diaries that Peter Morrison, who was an aide to Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, was an avid and noted pederast, and that she was worried that if this came out, it would be damaging. She wasn't worried that he was a pederast, but she was just, you know, worried that...
damage.
Yeah, I mean, like other people, that Peter Morrison was connected to Elm House. Elm House is a boarding house that was advertised through conservative magazines, and it was a brothel. And it was, you know, very clear from this ad that it was like a sort of sauna place and stuff like that. So, you know, it didn't take much working out to figure out perhaps there's something dodgy going off at this place. But various people have been connected to this place, like Peter Morrison, Cyril Smith, Anthony Blunt, who's the cousin to the Queen, and I think might be related to James Blunt, the pop star, but I could be completely wrong about that, so don't take that as fact. And then there's a pop star, an English pop star, that's taken out a super injunction, so he can't really speak about him, but he's kind of like a crap, virginal, Christian version of Elvis. So people might be able to work, and it's not Alvin Stardust, so people might be able to work out who that is, but they've taken out a super injunction. That particular pop star, again, it is alleged, used to be a rent boy for the Craze. Whether this is true or not, I do not know, but certainly it's an interesting point if it has any water.
Man.
Two people that basically admitted it was Max Clifford. I don't know if you guys know Max Clifford. He's like a media mogul.
I don't know of him.
He's big in England. He's one of these people that keeps stories out the paper and then controls...
A Rupert Murdoch.
No, he's more of a... He doesn't own the papers. He's just a
editor.
Facilitator. No. He's like a troubleshooter. He's the person that will make or break your careers. He's the person that made Simon Cowell into a huge entity by putting positive stories in the newspaper and ensuring that negative stories about his private life never make it. Stuff like the fact that he paid £50,000 towards the bail of noted paedophile Jonathan King. Things like that. That's the sort of thing that Max Clifford tries to keep out of the papers about Simon Cowell. One of the things that he tried to keep out of the papers but was secretly recorded was he was doing damage control for an MP called Alan Clark. And in this interview, he admitted that two of these girls that Alan Clark had an affair with were 14 at the time, but he said it was all right because the girls liked it and the parents liked the publicity and the wife liked the publicity, because obviously Alan Clark's marriage is an open relationship, so it's all just hype. They love it. It sells his book, it gets him on the newspaper and stuff like that. But he admitted that he'd covered up paedophilic activities and abuse of essentially children. Whether this was, you know, granted by the parents or not, that's not the point, really, is it? Another person that admitted it on a radio interview, I believe, was the former mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. And he admitted that basically, like what I believe is happening in the Wrexham and Bryn Allen and Elm House cases, that Kincora Boys Home was being used as a brothel in very similar circumstances, principally to entrap members of the IRA or members of Irish Parliament that was sympathetic to the IRA, but it didn't work. But again, he admitted that this was going on and this was a practice of the intelligence agencies. And, you know, this is all on record if people want to sort of to look it up. But that kind of ties in with the stories that I'm sure like your listeners are familiar with, McMartin Preschool and the Presidio trial and Johnny Gosch and Paul Benassi and the Franklin Savings and Loan scandal and the Boys Town. There seems to be running themes of children's homes, supposedly charitable entities, organizations, and then for whatever reason, a certain element of society, the elite, and certain celebrities. I mean, in that Nebraska case, the famous Franklin Savings and Loan scandal, which led to the admission that Paul Bonassi had 114 separate personalities programmed into his head by Lawrence King in open court, and that he had been part of an MKUltra program that involved satanic ritual, and that he had been used as a lure to basically go and get children off on their own round the corner so that CIA kidnappers could put them in the back of a van.
You know, this all came.
Yeah, I mean, this is all in the court cases and stuff like that. This was all exposed. And one of the people that he said that he kidnapped was Johnny Gosch, who might not be hugely familiar with people, but he was a famous, I think it was in the 80s, so it's, you know, it's a long time ago. But he was a famous paperboy that went missing in America. And then later turned up on Russian paedophile websites with a suspicious branded mark on his arm with other children that have been identified. And Paul Bonassi claimed that he was the person that kidnapped him, allegedly at the behest of a gentleman called Michael Aquino, who was at the time the highest ranking military officer in the NSA and the leader of the Temple of Set, which is an offshoot from Church of Satan. He alleged that this gentleman had ordered this kidnapping, and, you know, for whatever purpose. And it's interesting because there was another alleged scandal about Michael Aquino supposedly being involved in the abuse of certain children at the Presidio. They had daycare center,
right.
It's a very,
in
very
San Francisco.
Yeah, the famous case. I mean, Mr. Gary was the name of the teacher that basically got caught, but they did talk about other people that were involved, and it seemed, you know, a lot of it would, in all these cases, like McMartin and the Presidio, the initial response is that the children are lying, but the children have got chlamydia. So, you know, these are 5 years.
Right.
Now, I know that America's a little aggressive than England, but I don't think that that's the common occurrence for children to have chlamydia. Yeah. And then what happens, particularly with the McMartin preschool case, is you get people like the False Memory Syndrome Foundation coming in and saying these kids are making it up, or they're being programmed by their therapists. And then you look at it and you find that Pamela Freyd and her husband, who run the False Memory Foundation Syndrome, were accused of being abusing their daughter many, many times. Martin Orne, who's one of the chief hypnotists there, was one of the people that was doing hypnoprogramming on MKUltra. Ralph Underwager basically was a very prominent member of it until he started doing interviews in Pydeker, which is a Dutch paedophile magazine, saying that basically he said very various things, including children enjoy sex with adults, and that rape is a positive experience for 90% of women, or most women, or something like I paraphrase. And then books come out like the scandal, you know, the victimization of these poor parents accused of this stuff, and nothing went off, and the satanic panic and all this stuff. And one of the famous books was by Paul and Shirley Erberly, and this was discussing the McMartin preschool case. And it transpires that they used to run a magazine called Fist, which distributed child pornography and incest related pornography pictures and stories. And so you think maybe, just maybe, these people have got a vested interest, or perhaps are not to be, or perhaps need investigating a bit more.
Yeah.
And you know, it comes up time and time again. The Finders was another very famous case where a load of children were being transported across the border for to be taken to a school for special kids or gifted kids or whatever. And it transpired that it was a child sex pornography ring, kidnapping ring. And this was closed down when basically it was discovered this was a CIA internal affair. And so it was a CIA-run program. And again, these themes go again and again and again. One that you might not have heard of is a gentleman called Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein basically is a very, very powerful businessman, mogul, and friend of the royal family. He's a good friend and business partner with Prince Andrew. And he was exposed. He's been exposed paying for sex with children many times. But basically, he had a girl called Virginia Roberts, who was his personal masseuse. And she was enlisted by Ghislaine Maxwell, who's Robert Maxwell, who was the media mogul that died in very suspicious circumstances. She's his daughter. And through Rockefeller-ran golf clubs, she was a personal masseuse. They drugged her up to the nines, obviously, and pimped her out when she was about 14. And she's, you know, seen in photos with the Prince Andrew. You know, it's not been suggested that she slept with Prince Andrew or anything like that. But again, these connections are very, very unsavory.
Right. Well, man, you know, even child celebrities, they say a lot of them are supposedly used as sex slaves among politicians and producers. And this, you know, skeptical people have said to me, well, if people were really using Miley Cyrus as a child prostitute, they wouldn't put her under the spotlight like that. They would hide her from the public eye a bit. But
like
I think
James Dean and Marilyn Monroe. James Dean spent the majority of his early career being a rent boy. And Marilyn Monroe famously said that she spent more time on her knees than she did acting.
Yeah, I mean, if you make someone a mega celebrity, you actually restrict access to them. They get added security, managers, publicists, and I think that, I mean, just think how many obstacles you'd have to go past to reach someone like Miley Cyrus versus a regular person who claims to be a victim of this, you know?
And again, you see the same sort of, it does sound very, very strange if you look at the sort of MK Ultra things. And like, I've got a quote here that I just say, Charles Brown of the CIA, when talking to Dr. L. Wilson Green, said that children were used as subjects because they were more fun to work with and cheaper too. And then people like Ewan Cameron and hypnotists like Martin Orne and stuff like that were saying that children obviously dissociated easier. And so they were used in dozens and dozens of experiments. And, you know, this is all proven. And Monarch was a real program. Anton Chaitkin actually approached the only thing that we know about it. Well, these two things. Ted Gunderson claims that it's now called Monarch. That's all I know. Or claimed when I spoke to him and he said that. Anton Chaitkin approached William Colby at a press conference and said, what's happening with Monarch? And William Colby says, we don't do that anymore. We shut that down in the early 70s.
Yeah, it just admitted that it existed at one point.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, it's very strange. But then look at a lot of artists. You know, you get the same sort of meltdown again and again. Amanda Bynes has recently basically done her Britney Spears, hasn't she? You know, shaved her head. She wasn't the first person to do it. Margot Kidder did it years ago. Lois Lane shaved her head and pulled all her teeth out to stop the aliens from getting her. You know, Zsa Zsa Gabor did very, very strange. The one that people always seem to miss is Jodie Foster, who was a little blonde Disney girl.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything weird about Jodie Foster's early
childhood. Well, I mean, not about her childhood, but then all of a sudden she was sort of very, very sort of...
She came unhinged?
The John Hinckley thing. She was, you know, she was the reason that John Hinckley apparently tried to kill the president.
Oh, yeah,
Which I don't believe. And then she had a sort of a tumultuous private life. She got a lot of flack for basically being a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it's certainly worth a look at to see perhaps whether she was mucked about with. The famous ones are Corey Feldman and Corey Haim. You know?
Right. So yeah, Corey Feldman, apparently he did or he is writing a book that it contains some of that information about pedophilia at a young age.
It doesn't name any names, but it sort of implies that his mother knew that it was happening, but knew that it would be beneficial for his career. But it also says that Michael Jackson was not, in his opinion, a pedophile, and he was one of the people that treated him very, very well.
He looks like Michael Jackson seems like one of those textbook cases of perpetuating the cycle where people who are victims as children become abusers as adults. That's what it looks like to me.
I don't think there's any doubt that Michael Jackson was certainly abused by his father. I mean, whether he was sexually abused, there are stories that Tito and Jermaine have told of him being taken off and spending nights in motels with well-dressed white businessman and coming back and being ill for days afterwards.
Jesus. This is kind of off topic, but have you seen Sacha Baron Cohen's movie Bruno? There's a skit he does that's pretty telling where he pretends to be trying to hire babies to play parts in movies and commercials, and he interviews the parents and he asks them questions like, is your baby comfortable with high speeds and rapid acceleration? We're going to need to cover your baby with bees for this shot. Is that okay? And all the parents are like, yeah, no problem, because they so desperately want to see their kids in a movie.
Exactly. I mean, but this is the sort of the cognitive dissonance that people say. People will go, oh, yeah, of course, these Hollywood mothers, of course, these mothers that will push kids into their beauty pageants and, you know, give them like surgery when they're very young and, you know, all these sorts of things. People can accept that, but they don't seem to sort of take it to the next level. So you want to be Miss Alabama, you might have to sleep with a fat cowboy. You want to be Miley Cyrus, well, let's up that scale, shall we? And so you start to see where perhaps these things could be normalized and you know, and therefore used by people. I mean, you know, this is the thing. It's not certain that all these things, but again, that all these people were utilized in satanic ritual or mind control or anything like that. But there is certainly the symbolism there, and there's symbolism that you wouldn't know was there. I mean, there is an element of artists don't always get to say what's going in their video. 2 Chainz came out recently and says, look, everyone thinks I'm in the Illuminati because there was these 2 statues behind me. I didn't put those statues there. I was told to stand in front of those statues and dance.
Right.
And so there's that element. And then there's the what I call the ASAP Rocky version, where he does a video inside a an Enochian magic circle. And so everyone goes, oh, ASAP Rocky's in the Illuminati. And everyone goes and looks at the video. Now, there's a reason for that. So those artists, I think that there's sometimes it's utilized because people are becoming aware of it, and it will draw attention to the artist, a marketing campaign. And this works in a way like Gangnam Style. Once it's got 1 billion hits or whatever, you don't want to be the one person that's not seen it. And it's a strange thing about the human psyche. This is why polls come out before elections saying, oh, Obama's definitely going to win, because people will then go, I saw this poll that said Obama's definitely going to win. Sorry, what? Obama's definitely going to win. And before you know it, that's become the truism that is talked about. And so floating voters might be persuaded not to go, or other people might be persuaded to go with the winner as opposed to aligning themselves with a pointless loss.
Or I would say the whole voting thing is rigged anyway, and they put it in your head beforehand who's going to win, and then that person wins regardless of what any votes were, and then it's just like, oh well, that's the way it was going.
They give you 2 places you've got the choice, meat or fish. Well, that's not a choice. I don't want either of those. Well, tough. Then you don't get to say. Then you're an apathetic vote. Then you're, oh, dear, you're the worst person if you don't vote. It's like, do you want to get kicked to death? Or do you want to get, stabbed to death? Oh, I don't want either of those. Well, if you don't vote, you don't get, you've only got yourself to blame. It's ridiculous. I'll use this example again, and it's not to be taken seriously. 2 guys and a girl voting on who takes their clothes off. That's democracy.
Right.
It is. But basically, not to say that it abandon the system or anything like that, but just be aware that basically you're being sold a pig in a poke. And so it's the false choice. It's the illusion of choice. To quote George Carlin, you've got 2 political parties and 37 types of ice cream. So,
yeah, Carlin was great.
But the concept of this popularity thing, this is why people like Lady Gaga and Justin Bieber have had millions and millions of views taken off their YouTube accounts and Facebook accounts. This is why people buy Twitter followers, because people want to be aligned with winners. That's why gossip and social media and celebrity is so successful, because if you think of it in an instinctual way, they're the alpha male. They're on their big rock. Do you know what I mean? Look at them on the high rock. We know what they're doing. And you're constantly told that they're doing very well, because as we talked about earlier, you've got this completely false image of their lifestyle telling you that this is the way to make yourself happy. So you're sat there in your relative drudgery. You know, I haven't got a big ass chain. I've not got a Rolls Royce Phantom. It's none of that, I'm afraid. So, but I'd like it because they obviously seem so much happier. And I'm told that that's how to improve my lot.
Follow the leader.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what it is basically to simplify it back down, it's the concept of, if I've got Michael Jordan's shoes, maybe I might be able to get a bit of an edge and play basketball like Michael Jordan. I appreciate that Michael Jordan's very, very old. LeBron James. if I get his shoes, maybe I can play a bit like him. The idea is, if I can be a bit like that person, then I can be a bit like that person. And the more I'm like that person, the more I can, improve my lot in life. And this isn't just nonsense. Like, in laboratory experiments, chimpanzees will sometimes basically almost starve themselves to death, because rather than food, they'd rather have a photograph of the alpha male of their tribe, and they'll sit and they'll stare at it intently, because that's social information. If they've got a key, he looks very young, and that's because he's got a a fountain of youth in his back garden. Oh, bugger. Well, if I know how to get to that fountain of youth by studying his actions or movements, that's a very glib example, but that's the point. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? How come has this guy got all these girls? Maybe it's something to do with his watch. If I bought a watch like that, girls would be impressed.
It's that fedora. I got to get a fedora.
Exactly. And then it sort of spins on from that, you know, so girls are impressed by that. And then girls are told that that's a sign of a successful person. Look for someone with that particular watch. And so you start to fall into roles and you start mm-hmm. to sort of express yourself as an idea rather than being you, because you don't want to be you, because it's been proved time and time again that you're not brilliantly successful in this world. So what you want to do is you want to be the better you. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you an example of that, Facebook. Because every single person on there, like, Facebook is akin to gambling. It's like this social information. And mm-hmm. this is how people get addicted to Facebook. You type your status or whatever, that's like a gamble. You might get a positive response or a negative response, or you might get no response. If you get no response, it's going to bum you out a bit.
That's the worst.
Yeah, exactly. So you put something else up, and that sort of informs you that you're doing well and you're doing this. Like, putting something down or liking something is akin to how outrageous you do it. It's like putting down big stakes, for example.
It's finding your place in the social pyramid by measuring likes and shares.
I'll tell you this, right? Nobody tells exactly, and I've had loads of people say, yes, I do. No, you don't. You can't. You can't explain and express the wonderful, beauteous, complicated nature of you in a few Facebook statuses. You can give the edited highlights, like match mm-hmm. of the day. Or, right. you know, whatever. That's not always a realistic representation of what's going on. What does that tell you psychologically? It tells you that this slimmed down, new, improved version of you on the social media is better than you.
Yeah, more popular. The more popular
version.
It's
got more friends than you.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting element. Yeah.
You should try and become more like that person. Mm-hmm. And then that's terrifying.
Be more shallow.
Yeah. And that's tied into... everyone's on their smartphones all the time, everyone's on their iPhones and stuff like that. You know, people are walking around like zombies because that takes the edge off. It's like when people are in war situations, journalists find themselves looking very intently through their viewfinder because that separation of a screen makes it feel like you're not quite there. This is why it's easy to be horrible or to troll people or to be flirtatious when you're online, because it's not real. But this is why when you've been chatting to someone online for 6 months and then you go and finally meet them, you still have that awkwardness of the first human contact, because it doesn't alleviate that. Mm-hmm. But basically, because you're doing that through your smartphone and stuff like that, you're on Facebook and all these different sites, yearning for the acceptance of some people who are your friends, but some people who are basically morons, to be quite honest, because, like, the populist view is usually wrong. And then there's another thing. Phones have been marketed in such a way, particularly iPhones. There's a Harvard study done a few years ago now. People react to phones in the same way that they react to loved ones. It's not that it's dopamine or serotonin. It's not a pleasure response like drugs. People are starting to love their phones because their phone is the access to all this stuff that makes you feel like a real, in inverted commas, person, which is terrifying. Like, yeah. In experiments, they were showing basically just flashing up or doing the iPhone's ringtone. And when people hear that, they react in the same synaptic way that they would if they saw their boyfriend or girlfriend.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, man. It's terrifying. Like, absolutely terrifying. And but, you know, this is very clever marketing campaigns and very, like, understanding of the human psyche. And, yeah, I mean...
it's messed up.
Yeah.
You know, earlier you had mentioned Carlin, and it jolted in my memory. Cat Williams, you know, I was a big fan of his. What happened to Cat Williams? He had a pretty public blowout.
Yeah, I mean, it's very strange, that, because... I'm too big fan of Cat Williams. He did the bit. I can never remember which it was. I can't remember if it's American Hustle or it's Pimpin' or...
I think it's Pimpin'.
Where he's doing the bit about, there's two dudes kissing, like, and yeah. stuff, and saying he was at the parties and bits and bobs like that. He's done a lot since then. The last one, I think, he did Cat Apelix. I think that was in this year, but I could be wrong. And he was very... spiritually, he was basically it was very, very funny, but he seemed to be on the sort of, like, a sort of kind of religious tip, but it was good. It was good. He was very positive mm-hmm. and such like that. But then he's had a lot of ups and downs, court cases, and announced his retirement. Foolishly, he got he was hanging out with Suge Knight. Like, that's a mistake. Suge Knight, I mean, yeah. Just like what we were talking about earlier, basically, Death Row. We're talking about this setting of trends. Death Row was financed indirectly by the CIA through a bloke called Michael Harris and Freeway Ricky Ross, who was getting money directly, getting cocaine directly from the Medellin and the Nicaraguan cartels that were being basically financed by the Iran-Iraq-Contra to promote crack cocaine through South Central. And, you know, obviously you know about the crack explosion in the 80s, which was suspiciously in black dominated areas. And then it was in all these, if you go back and watch the news reports on crack, every single one of them is an advertisement. This new incredibly potent but cheap but incredibly potent, really powerful drug that's coming out at the minute. And you know where we're getting at the minute, and sorry to digress, Breaking Bad. I'm a huge fan of Breaking Bad, but does not show you what meth is like. They're smoking meth like they smoke like people smoke weed. That's not what happens with meth. Like meth, you're up for days and days and days, right? So I'm very curious about that, because Breaking Bad is an incredibly good show, but its portrayal of methamphetamine use, which is what the program is about, is completely erroneous. Sorry to go back to crack cocaine. This also tied in, I'm not sure how old you were, but at the time it basically, Scarface came out, which offered a kingpin lifestyle. You'd had the Mac and you'd had various other Superfly and other programs like that. And that was sort of very, very sort of centralized. But this was a mainstream film that had a non-white kingpin Robin Hood type hero that could be a this is a way to get out of the ghetto and stuff like that. This is tying in with Death Row, publicized heavily by Vibe magazine. Quincy Jones, obviously you may have heard the rumors about Quincy Jones, whether these are true or not, I don't know, essentially in the boule and trying to have sex with Tupac. Whether this is true or not sure. Tupac interestingly made certain claims that Dr. Dre was gay when he had a falling out with him. Whether that was just his way of having a dig at him or whether that was true, we don't know. But
that's what the Cat Williams joke was all about.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, so, you know, the same themes again and again and again. You know, at what point does it become a pattern? Mm-hmm. But Vibe magazine was also financed or had finance streams from the CIA. And the point of Death Row was it took away from positive elements like, say, Public Enemy. Griff talks about this. Professor Griff talks about this a lot. But basically, it seemed to sort of offer a new paradigm, if you like. This is what rap's about. It's khakis, black T-shirts, gangster rap, lowriders, guns. This is – and it's – you know, so it's selling this image to young black men, saying, actually, right. No, this isn't a bad idea. But it's also demonizing them, because every white person from middle America or England or whatever goes, oh my God, this is what all black people are like. Well, it must be, because, you know, that's all that we see on the news. And then Snoop Doggy Dogg comes over to England and gets banned, and this just confirms it for us. And so basically you're giving this stereotype, which becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, the concept of, look, if you're going to treat me like an animal, I'm going to start behaving like an animal and see how you like that. And so this is the problem. And then basically that keeps going and going and going to the point where the racism is so endemic that young black people in a certain part of America cannot get jobs, cannot walk down the street without being harassed by the police. But you're not getting songs like Fuck the Police anymore talking about police brutality. Or
unfortunately not.
You're getting drive-by anthems and stuff like that, which is a very, very subtle change, because people say that NWA were gangster rap, and you'd be an idiot to say that they didn't have gangster elements, but they were more storytelling and talking about social realism, and they combine that with an ethos of, you know, public sensibility, police brutality, and social commentary. They weren't Public Enemy. No, they weren't. Public Enemy would taking it to the next level, and they were obviously the best at that. But it was that sort of, you know, people don't seem to realize that there was a very overt change to being very, very gangster. I mean, I know NWA did the song Gangster Gangster, Boogie Down Productions, Criminal Minded. I'm aware of these songs, but the sort of rap became gangster rap, and that's all it was at a certain point in the 90s, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bringing with it all the problems that came out of it. And again, sort of hyping up the gang tensions and situations, which, by the way, Tupac actually managed to stop for a short time with his Thug Life and his connections to the Black Panthers. He managed to get a ceasefire in South Central Los Angeles between the Bloods and the Crips, which Suge Knight reignited the night of his death. But, I mean, that's the other thing, that the corruption of the youth with the creation of these, you know, people to, it's a gang, the gangs. I mean, that's mm-hmm. for little white kids and stuff like that. Your gang is Good Charlotte, Lady Gaga, whatever crap. Okay, right. When you're in a sort of certain demographic, unfortunately, sometimes the only family structure and family unit that you have is the gang life, Crips and Bloods and such like that. And aside from the sort of, if you look at all those things, like, there's a certain amount of satanic imagery in all of their symbolism, you know. But what's interesting is that they were formed as sort of offshoots of the then criminalized Black Panther Party to protect black youths from skinhead gangs that were running around California beating the shit out of people. Mm-hmm. And then they were corrupted by the introduction of drugs. Now, is this just a perfect storm, or is this some sort of planned social maneuver? Well, I know where
I'm to know.
Well, I know where I'm putting my hat. I'm going to put it in planned social maneuver, because it just seems that Liza was saying, once is fair enough, but twice is a correlation, but we're getting all these the same instances again and again and again, controlling huge swathes of the population, directing your attention to essentially stuff that's not really that important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is definitely messed up and well orchestrated. One other element about Hollywood that I wanted to ask you about is, have you looked into this theory of the $20 million club, where it's been suggested that to reach a net worth of $20 million and receive a special position within the Hollywood hierarchy, one must perform a blood sacrifice? People talk about Kanye and his mother who died suspiciously, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, yeah, I mean, it's who knows with that particular one. There seems to be some sort of a correlation with people that would go to that very, very top echelon and lose somebody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can go down the list and there's a lot of them. Difficult to say, again.
What's coincidence and what's a pattern, you know?
And what's a pattern? Absolutely. There's nothing that would go... that would be called like hardcore court evidence that I've seen that suggests, but it does happen time and time again. Certainly Kanye West was very strange. Was it Jennifer Hudson's families died in very bizarre ritualistic killings and such like that. And yeah, people die. it's certainly
Ashton. I think Ashton Kutcher has an ex who was apparently killed by a serial killer. That's a little odd.
Oh, really? Well, I mean, this is the thing. You dig and you find out that a lot of people that have got to that level have. I mean, there are obviously these lists on the internet. Some of them are more tenuous than others. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you could find some people that got to the top that basically, I don't know whether they've died. And then there's some people that basically, you know, they say that Dr. Dre's kid was sacrificed, but that was when he was already successful. People would say John Travolta's kid was sacrificed. I'm not discounting it, but he was already successful at that point. So who knows? I mean, it very much depends on what you believe. And a lot of people mm-hmm. might find it quite hard to believe because what we're talking about is, for want of a better word, satanic ritual.
Another one that's a little strange is, you know, Mike Tyson had already had huge success, but then just a few years ago, his kid died while running on a treadmill, who accidentally hung himself on a treadmill, or his daughter.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, now he's in The Hangover. Now he's getting a roast on Comedy Central.
Yeah.
He's back in the spotlight as a parody, but yet, you know, he is back in the spotlight. And you could look at the timeline and maybe he did.
People just, well, damn, he's had a bit of a hard time. You know what? He used to be my friend. I'm going to help him out. Again, I'm not saying that. But again, this is the point. You have to be, I can see the, I can see what people mean with that. I don't know. I don't know whether that's true, but it certainly is very suspicious. The amount of people that seem to have someone particularly close to them die just at the point that they, peak.
Reach some critical success. But yeah, it is hard to discern. You know, sometimes it's on the downswing. It is a really weird phenomenon. I mean, some people were suggesting that Mary-Kate Olsen, for example, her sacrifice was Heath Ledger. I'm like, well, Mary-Kate Olsen, what the hell is she doing now? She's not doing shit.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't know. I mean, again, you could. That this is where you need to be careful about speculation and like I said, coming to something with a premise, because we have the premise that Mary-Kate Olsen, that Heath Ledger was Mary-Kate Olsen's sacrifice. We could probably in the next 5 minutes think of about five reasons that was plausible. Like, for example, she's not done brilliantly well, but she's not gone off the rails. So was that her, you know, saying that? That's bullshit. I've just made that up. But this is the point when you come to something with a supposition, you start with a supposition. So it's difficult, but I wouldn't tell people to stop looking at it. Because as I say, this is, you know, only so many times this can happen before people go, hang on.
Right. But you don't want to get that confirmation bias either.
No. I mean, you know, Marlon Brando, Bill Cosby, all of these people have had people die in their lives. But again, they were very famous when this actually happened. Doesn't discount that possibility. But who knows? Who knows, to be honest? I mean, it's apparent that certain things do go on. I mean, this is what I was going to say, that people find it difficult, the concept of satanic ritual. And it doesn't matter if you believe that, there's a lot of evidence that this happened. Martin Priestcourt trial, Presidio trial. Linda Goldstein was a very eminent journalist, and she found that at the Presidio, in the places where the children said they were being abused, they were designated satanic murals and altars and satanic architecture and all this. Essentially, it was a satanic church or whatever whatever is the equivalent. On the grounds of the Presidio. So there are certain people that take the OTO as a real organization. The Temple of Set, the Church of Satan, these are real organizations. How seriously they take it or whatever is debatable. Mm-hmm. But again and again, you get reports with Cyril Smith. There was reports of quasi-satanic ritual. With Jimmy Savile, there was reports of quasi-satanic ritual. We're saying quasi because, you know, Satanism, I'm very sure, is just like any other religion. There are various denominations and there are various different things that certain people believe. And I'm just using Satanism as a coverall term. But again, you get all these sort of, it happens again and again and again. When the satanic panic happened, the Jeffrey McDonald case actually holds a lot of water. The satanic panic that happened in Nottingham actually holds a lot of water. By mysterious and bizarre coincidence, I happen to know one of the families that fostered one of the girls that was the key witness in the case. Damn. And they said, they basically confirmed everything that she said: satanic ritual, abused implements put in a vagina in graveyards and stuff like that, and she was only a child. And they said, with the best will in the world, not wanting to be horrible, this girl was stupid. She was like a box of hair. Like, she wasn't bright enough to make this up and consistently tell the same very, very detailed story again and again and again and again and again. Now, I'm not sure if this is true, but this is certainly what I was told. Although the case was thrown out of court, she got a flat and some money afterwards. I don't know if that's true, but again, this is what makes I was told. Think. If it is true, it certainly, you know, makes you think.
Man, makes me so skeptical, the whole damn thing. You know, sometimes you see a new director who hits the scene or a new musician who appears to top the charts overnight, like this Macklemore guy. And now I look at him and I think, man, I like that thrift shop song, but you probably had to fuck a few kids or bleed someone out on an altar to get that kind of radio play.
Well, I mean, again, the thing with Macklemore is he's done it through an independent setup.
Well, right.
Again, I'm not entirely sure that I believe that. I mean, certainly, I mean, I don't know whether because it's downloadable that basically the outlay money's gone, but like, people don't, the promotion that you would need, this concept of viral marketing and stuff like that, do you know how much money that costs? Justin Bieber was not a viral overnight sensation. Gangnam Style was not a viral overnight sensation. They were the work of Scooter Braun, who is an expert in his field at creating viral marketing.
Mm-hmm. Same with people talk about the Kony film, that being all propaganda as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Pussy Riot. that just so happened to be financed by the American, the Department of Defense. I forget, one element of American military financed their one and only single, because they're not a real band. They're a publicity.
Really?
Yeah, they've not got any music. How are they a punk band? About as punk rock as Darcy Bustle. Like, honestly, man, they're not a punk band. Leftover Crack are a punk band, right? Morning Glory are a punk band, right?
All I know about the Pussy Riot thing is just that Putin locked him up, and it makes me feel like Russia's some crazy, scary place, you know?
Well,
but I mean, guess
I wonder about this, because there's a lot of, whether it is that just Russia, I mean, the sort of the anti-homosexuality bill and such like that, Russia is positioning itself, whether this is Western propaganda, I don't know, but it's certainly being portrayed more and more that Russia is not a very tolerant place to live. Whether this is true or not, I don't know, because I've never been there. I can only go off the sort of reports. What's mm-hmm. slightly interesting is that the news channel that is given the most credence is Russia Today.
Yeah, that is a weird thing. I totally agree with that. I see a lot of stuff on Russia Today that I really like, and it seems so, it's like got a liberal side. It seems very truth oriented, but then you hear these stories of what's going on. It seems very backwards. Well, I don't know. It almost sounds like North Korea sometimes.
Exactly. Well, this is the point, but I don't buy that. I don't really buy the fact that Russia is the good guys in this regard, because basically, you mean, the Russian Revolution was financed by British military intelligence. Like the Frankfurt School, which is where people get this erroneous concept of cultural Marxism, was financed by the Tavistock Organization and British intelligence, and then went over to American Columbia University and such like that. The Cold War, we know to be a fallacy. Like the phrase Cold War has been attributed to Walter Lippmann, who qualify, you know, because you need a quantitative term, because so that people can understand what's going on. We can't just have big, scary nuclear threat, because people go, oh, we'll explain it to me. No, no, no. What we've got is a Cold War. A what? A Cold War! Be scared! like we've got a war on terror. We've got a war on drugs. We've got Al-Qaeda. You need labels and names so that people can understand it. This is why people get so bent out of shape when some sort of like cross-genre new music comes in. It's like, what the? This is bullshit. This has got elements of stuff I like, but like, oh my God, I can't cope with it. People like to be categorized sometimes because it offers a psychological security. Like, I'll give you an example, right? Okay. A film comes on the television. I'm sat here bored out of my mind. I've got Chinatown over there. I'm looking at it right now. It's on DVD. It's by that notable paedophile, Roman Polanski. but I don't want to watch Chinatown. I don't want to watch Chinatown. But then it comes on the television, and I go, oh, yeah, I'll watch Chinatown. Brilliant. It's a great film. I'll watch Chinatown. Why is that? And everybody does that. You've got a film that you could watch at any time, but you don't want to bother. But then when it's on the television, you'll sit there and happily watch it. Why?
And with commercials, too.
Yeah. You know why? It's because it's taking the responsibility away from you.
And those alpha waves.
Well, aside from that, the television and the eye fixation is actually, it's not, people sometimes get confused. They think that the alpha waves are emitting from the television. What it is it used to be to do with the flicker rate. I'm not sure that happens anymore because of plasma and such like that. What it is, it's to do with eye fixation. You know, just to be again glib, but look at my swinging watch. You are feeling sleepy, very sleepy, very sleepy. That's called an eye fixation. Now that's, you don't use a watch, you just use your finger. But technically, all you need to do to put someone in trance is just look at the tip of my finger, keep looking at the tip of my finger, and then you do a certain thing, and they fall into a trance. Because hypnosis is just, again, it's not like a Vulcan mind meld. All you're doing really with hypnosis in the initial stages, until you get into real nasty traumatizing effects and splitting personalities and stuff like that, all you're doing is you're distracting the conscious mind so that there's no critical analysis, so that basically you're speaking directly to the subconscious or the autopilot. And this is why basically you drive along and you'll be like, oh, what am I going to have for dinner tonight? Oh, Christ, I was supposed to turn left there. Or alternatively, you realize, oh, God, I was supposed to go to work and instead I've driven to my bloody mother's. What's gone on? That's because you weren't concentrating, but your autopilot took over. Do you know what I mean? And so it's only when you're distracted or in danger that your conscious mind comes back into play. You can still cope and go. Like, that's despite being called hypnosis, hypnos was the god of sleep, it's not the same as sleep. It's a different state of mind. And that's all it is. But the interesting thing about that is with this eye fixation, very, very soon, it takes about 4 seconds for your critical analysis to bypass. And this is how advertisers are so successful, because basically they don't need to win an argument. They've already won an argument with you. If they can present an image and align it to something that you perceive as positive, they've got you, because you've got no defense mechanism to argue.
Right.
So that's how advertising works.
It's fucked up, man. I mean, does anything real happen anymore? I mean, even major political scandals that seemed real are scripted from the beginning.
Oh, of course they are. Frost died recently, Sir David Frost. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, David Frost, he's the guy that got Nixon to admit that he was wrong. Bullshit.
Scripted.
Yes, entirely scripted. If you believe Alex Constantine's research, which I do, the whole point of the Watergate scandal, this is the thing. You can always tell. Nigella Lawson's doing it at the minute. She's been accused in court, like, it's not part of the case, but she's been accused of being a massive cocaine addict, which she may very well be. So her defense, and this is called the celebrity defense, I don't know if it's called that, there's probably a real name for it, but this is what I call it. When you're accused of something terrible, you go in there and you admit to something not quite so terrible. What's happened with every single celebrity involved in the inquiries surrounding child sex in the 70s that's going on at the minute, is every single one of them's come forward and says, no, I'm not a paedophile. I am a drug addict, or I am cheating on my wife with adults, or I am an alcoholic. So, yeah, I'm a bit of a bastard, but I'm not that much of a bastard. And what's really, really bizarre is people feel sorry for you because they feel, oh, he's had the humility to admit his faults, but that doesn't make him a monster. That's the same defense that you'll see time and time again. Ian Watkins was going to do that, saying that basically, I'm not a pedophile, I'm a crystal meth addict. Yeah. That was going to be his defense.
I've had girlfriends pull that shit on me in college and high school. Well, we kissed, but we didn't fuck.
Yes, exactly. It's a very, very similar scenario. But basically, yeah, these are methods of manipulating public opinion.
Yeah.
And again, you know, this is where people like Max Clifford, who we spoke about right at the beginning of the show, who's protecting paedophiles like Alan Clark, and he's actually currently being investigated for various sex offences, though we don't know what they are. I don't think he'll get caught. I think this is the other thing with all these celebrities, aside from Ian Watkins, which is just so sensational that there was just no way that he couldn't get caught, and Jimmy Savile, because he's dead, I think the majority of them will basically get away with it, essentially, or be found in court that there's not enough evidence or something like that. Doesn't mean that they are innocent, but again, I strongly believe that a lot of these cases that come out, particularly the Ian Watkins and such like that, they must be a distraction for something else. But again, it's very strange. I mean, we'll find out more things with the Lost Prophets thing. So again, I don't think anyone should go with the supposition that entertainment industry, successful in the entertainment industry, child sex, well, it must be the Illuminati, because it's not necessarily so. But, you know, it's a very, very bizarre case. I think it certainly wants looking at. But again, yeah. Is it more a testament to what, like you were saying earlier, like the Bruno thing, the cult of celebrity, and how seemingly horrific things can be normalized, even on a microcosmical level, like with that, where he's managed to persuade, I mean, obviously there's been dozens, but like so far we know of two women that he's managed to persuade to give up their children for sex purely on the basis of their adulation with his celebrity.
Hoping that they'll absorb some of his talent.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's how people should look at it, as a microcosm for just how stupid you can be. I mean, people will buy Nike stuff just because LeBron James or whoever it is wearing them.
And we know those kids aren't that great at sewing shoes.
Exactly. Well, this is the point. There's slave labor. But and the same thing with iPhones. But people forget that because they want it.
Right. That's what makes me laugh when someone gets on my case about an offensive joke. And I'm like, hey, I'm just talking here. You know, you're actually typing on a device that was made by slave children. So you can shut the fuck up about your offense to my joke.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, if someone is offended, tough. That's tough, unfortunately. Right. Like, you have the right to be offended, and I'll fight to the death for your right to be offended. But I'll also fight for your right to offend me. So, you know, that's very dangerous. That's another sort of perception management thing where basically certain things are acceptable and certain things are unacceptable. And it is a very, very tricky sort of thing, you know. You know what? This is the thing that people misconstrue. They misunderstand political correctness or whatever we're calling this with or... well, how come then I can't say the N-word then? How come you say that's racist and stuff like that? You can say it, okay, but it's not polite. It's rude, okay? You can say that if you want, but accept that that's fucking rude. And so people might respond in such a way that you can say the C-word if you want. I know Americans get offended by it, so I shan't say it.
No,
don't say
no.
It for your grand, though. That's the point. You know what I mean?
Right.
People misconstrue this. Well, you shouldn't say that. So, no, there's a difference between not being allowed to have an opinion and just being that does like free speech does not give you the right to just be rude and get away with it.
Right. But sometimes you need extreme words to express extreme things, you know? Sometimes people act cunty and you have to be able to say that's how they're acting.
Exactly. Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with that. But again, like, yeah, absolutely. Spot on, man.
Oh, man. Neil, it's been a blast. You know, you're the man. That pretty much does it for us. You know, I really appreciate you coming on.
Oh, no. Enjoyed it, man.
Just fascinated with these stories of all these covert, dark Hollywood agendas and all this ritual behavior. But do you want to give the people your website or tell them a little bit about anything you're working on before we call it a day?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my website is neilsandersmindcontrol.com, and I'm also on Facebook, even though I've spent a long time decrying it today. So if people want to come on there and boost my likes and make me feel good, then that'd be great. Seriously, if you want to go on Facebook, I tend to put stuff on there every day, you know, just to let people see what I'm talking about or whatever. And I've also written two books, or they're two volumes of the same book, really. Your Thoughts, Not Your Own. Mind Control, Mass Manipulation and Perception Management, which is volume one. And that deals with like the nuts and bolts of the Tavistock Institute and the beginnings of MKUltra and all the doctors involved, the techniques. It moves on then to psychotronics, Manchurian candidates, admitted monarch slaves, the uses of children. And then it winds up talking about serial killers, because a lot of serial killers tend to have connections to military industrial complex or directly to mind control programs. And then the second volume is called Marketing, Movies and Music, and it talks about those industries basically, how they're utilized for social control, how advertising works and how music can be used in color and sound. And then the various industries, the music industry, it touches on a bit on what we've talked about today, and the film industry, the television industry, the media industry and the newsprint industry and things like that. Lots of little snippets, like the CIA owns more publishing houses. It owns 40 times more publishing house or publishes 40 times more publications than the next largest publishing house in America. So when you go to the newsstand, just think who's actually behind all of those magazines. And they're available from our website. They're also available from David Icke Books, and they're also available from richplanet.net, which is an excellent website. It's got a monthly web show on there, and people should check it out. And yeah, if anyone's got any questions or anything like that, feel free to email me or anything like that. And thanks very much, Greg, for having me on.
Fascinating stuff, man. Yeah, thanks again, Neil. Keep fighting the good fight.
Cheers, man.
Wow, people, there we have it. Neil Sanders, full of info. I really liked that one. So with that, enjoy the holidays. Please remember the THC Money Bomb. We're going every 5 episodes now, so 85, 90, 95. Next one will be on 90. And also please remember the THC Stitcher Awards up until the day that it matters. Here's a little Christmas song by Jonathan Colton from the not-too-distant future. Your move, Suge Knight.
This year has been a little crazy for the Andersons. You may recall we had some trouble last year. The robot council had us banished to an asteroid that hasn't undermined our holiday cheer. And we know it's almost Christmas by the marks we make on the wall. That's our favorite time of year. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta Prime, where we're working in a mine for our robot overlords. Did I say overlords? I meant protectors. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta Prime.
every corner there's a giant metal Santa Claus who watches over us with glowing red eyes. They carry weapons and they know if you've been bad or good. Not everybody's good, but everyone tries. And the rocks outside the airlock exude ammonia-scented snow. It's like a winter wonderland. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta Prime, where we're working in a mine for our robot overlords. Did I say overlords? I meant protectors. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta Prime. That's all the family news that we're allowed to talk about. We really hope you'll come and visit us soon. I mean, we're literally begging you to visit us and make it quick before they...
Message redacted.
Now it's time for Christmas dinner. I think the robot sent us a pie. You know I love my soil and green. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta Prime, where we're working in a mine for our robot overlords. Did I say overlords? I meant protectors. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta.